everybody, this is Dan Walker. Welcome to another edition of U.S. Law Radio. Well, the world is becoming a smaller place every day, especially when it comes to doing business in places like the European Union. But the laws are unsurprisingly different there, and it only makes sense to have counsel who understands these differences. Charles Price is a Belgium-qualified lawyer with the law firm CW & Partners in Brussels. Charles has not only studied the ins and outs of contracting in the EU, but has considerable experience acting on behalf of foreign companies. Let's get some insight. Charles, welcome into U.S. Law Radio.
Thank you.
Charles, tee things up for us. We hear a lot about the European Union, but what does the EU really represent in terms of opportunities to U.S. companies?
Well, the EU is 27 member states. It's a market of some 500 million people. It's in fact 7% of the world's population. It's the world's largest exporter and the second largest importer. And in fact, its most important trading partner is the U.S.
Do you view the EU as sort of the United States of Europe?
Well, yes and no. Increasingly, legislation is done at the pan-European level. But the EU still remains 27 separate member states with 27 different national parliaments, and indeed some regional parliaments on top of the national parliaments. But the principle of subsidiarity is enshrined in the Treaty of European Union, and the principle of subsidiarity means that legislation is done at the European level only if it can't be done at the national level, and if the legislative objectives are better achieved at the European rather than the national level. I would say that for companies operating in Europe, including US companies, roughly 50% of the laws and regulations that they come across originate from the EU level and about 50% from the national level.
Okay, well, educate us, Charles. What types of things are governed by legislation at the EU level?
Well, I think the most well-known example is antitrust, which all the rules of which are now dictated or set out at an EU level, although there are still national competition authorities. Other areas where the EU legislator has been very active are areas like consumer protection, privacy, intellectual property, although unfortunately we don't yet have a European community patent, and also in the regulatory field where the EU has been very active in breaking down national trade barriers as between the various member states.
Okay, then on the flip side of the coin, what are the areas governed by the rules at the national level?
There you've got things like employment law, pensions, social security, environment, which are all areas where, although there are EU provisions, the majority of the legislation is still done at the national level. Taxes, with the exception of VAT, are still largely established, and the rules for taxes established at the national level. And areas like real property and planning approvals are regulated almost entirely at the national level.
Well, the big question we'd like to focus on then is, how can U.S. companies benefit from the fact that a lot of the rules are made at the EU level rather than the national level?
Yes, well, the EU treaty does provide, and it's one of its essential provisions, for the freedom to provide services, the freedom of establishment throughout the EU. And U.S. companies with a base in Europe can benefit from these principles. An example would be a U.S. bank or financial services company, which is established, we say, in the U.K., and which can use its UK license as a passport to obtaining regulatory control and approval in all the other EU member states. Another good example is trademark law. The community trademark, or the CTM as we call it, is valid across all 27 member states on the basis of one single central registration, which costs 900 euros. And for that, you get trademark protection across the EU, across all the 27 member states.
Okay, good. Now let's talk specifically about contract law, Charles. In Europe, is there a uniform contract law, you know, something like the Uniform Commercial Code that we have here in the U.S.?
No, contract law remains regulated by national laws. In 2010, the European Commission did produce a policy paper on developing a more coherent approach to contract law across the whole EU. That paper is now out for consultation, but it's fair to say I think that there is still a very long way to go before that becomes anything like hard law. And that's due really to the fact that in the EU, We still have the division between the civilist and the common law traditions, and that produces a lot of difficulties in the field of contract law. And I think, indeed, in the U.S., it's one of the reasons that Louisiana has not signed up to the Uniform Commercial Code. There are a number of soft law options. There are things like the principles of European contract law or the UNIDROIT principles of international commercial contracts, but they're soft law and they have to be explicitly chosen by the parties in order to be applicable, and in practice they're rarely used.
Okay, so I suppose the basic rule of freedom of contract applies, and the parties are free then to stipulate what they want in their contract?
Yes, you're right. A freedom of contract is a fundamental rule present in the national contract rules of most EU member states. But you have to be careful, and you have to qualify that by the fact that there is a system of mandatory rules which apply irrespective of what the parties have put in their contract. And these mandatory rules can be not only public policy matters, but also so-called imperative rules, which are often designed to protect the weaker party in a contract and which apply irrespective of what's actually written in the contract. And even when the parties have stated in the contract that the weaker party waives his rights. And you find those imperative rules in fields such as agency and distribution, consumer protection, employment law, rental arrangements, security of tenure, that kind of thing.
Okay, Charles, now if I were to ask you what the golden rule might be for U.S. companies contracting with companies in the EU, what would that be?
Well, I think there are probably several golden rules, but I can perhaps choose two. One, I think, is don't assume that because you have a U.S. standard contract which your co-contractor has agreed and signed, that you're home and dry. We frequently run across the example of U.S. companies appointing distributors in Belgium under a contract which is under U.S. law, which provides for the jurisdiction of the U.S. courts. But there is, in fact, a law in Belgium which protects distributors in the event of termination, which gives them the right to termination and client indemnities. And that law specifically says that it applies notwithstanding any choice of foreign law in the contract. And it also says that any attempt in the contract to waive the distributor's rights to the indemnities is null and void. So notwithstanding the fact that the U.S. company has what seems to be a valid contract, it ends up in a Belgian court faced with Belgian law provisions which it didn't contract to have incorporated in its contract, but which become a part of the contract as a matter of law. A second golden rule, I think, would be never, never terminate a contract without taking proper advice and considering things, because there are formal rules as to how you terminate a contract. There are rules in some cases as to language, as to form of notification, as to timing, and there are even substantive rules. One of the cases that we frequently come across is an employment contract where the employer wants to terminate the contract for serious cause because the employee has done something very serious. He's been guilty of theft or fraud or whatever, and he wants to terminate the contract. But under our employment laws, such termination is only valid if it's done within 3 days of the employer becoming aware of the fact which justifies the termination. And this 3-day rule causes endless problems in litigation that we have with foreign parties who don't understand and who haven't comprehended the rule.
So it'd be prudent then for U.S. companies to just not assume that the rules that they're used to in the U.S. also apply in Europe.
Yes, I think that's right. A good example would be unfair competition. We've just been acting for a U.S. company which won a new contract from a major global IT company. In order to service the contract, they hired 25 people away from their major competitor who had previously been supplying the same global IT company, and they were immediately threatened with injunction proceedings on the basis of an unfair competition statute. We were able to demonstrate that they had done nothing unfair, but it was by no means easy, and I think it's fair to say that the client was very surprised to learn that hiring people away from a competitor could, depending on the circumstances, amount to an act of unfair competition.
Well, Charles, let's shift gears here for a second. Can you talk to us about the role lawyers play in advising their clients on contracts? Are there any differences between the situation in the U.S. and the situation in Europe?
Yes, there are important differences. Ethical and bar rules, for example, prevent lawyers in many jurisdictions from testifying in cases on behalf of their own client. And indeed, as a young lawyer, I almost fell foul of that rule in a European competition case when we were acting for an airline against a national flag carrier. Other examples, the rules of privilege are very different. I think you're familiar in the U.S. with the attorney-client privilege, but we have a sort of attorney-attorney privilege, which means that correspondence between lawyers is confidential and privileged and can't be used in court. Another example would be that there is an absolute prohibition on contacts between lawyers and witnesses, which is not at all the kind of thing that you're used to in the US, but we cannot contact a witness that we're going to call in our case, and we can't prepare witnesses. We also have no developed system of discovery, so there is very much emphasis on lawyers trying to collect written evidence, but we don't have discovery at our fingertips in order to do that, which means the proof of the facts can be difficult. Last but not least, in the proceedings, there's a great emphasis on written proceedings. There are several rounds of written pleadings which are exchanged prior to the actual hearing. For instance, in Belgium, the average commercial case, the oral hearing in court will only last 2 hours, which is something which surprises U.S. lawyers.
Of course. And do you want to talk about the dispute resolution in Europe? Because we all know, Charles, things can go wrong contract-wise.
Yes, quite right, Dan. And indeed, you need to pay much attention, careful attention when negotiating the contract. If there's nothing in the contract as to a choice of law and choice of jurisdiction, your only choice in general is to sue your co-contractor in the local courts of the jurisdiction where he is established. That's obviously not the best choice. It raises questions of whether there is any local or national bias, which is not necessarily widespread, but which does exist in some jurisdictions from country to country. More important, perhaps, is the question of language and local procedural rules. These can involve long delays and court proceedings that go on for years with possibilities of appeal. All that is an obstacle to parties wishing to do business and to progress. And personally, I'm very much in favor of arbitration, which is widely accepted in Europe and which allows the parties to determine not only the languages of the proceedings, but also many of the procedural rules. So I think that's a very good option for most foreign companies operating in Europe.
Well, Charles, lots of useful information from an insider's perspective there in the EU. So wrap it up for us. Any last words for those interested in doing business there in the region?
Well, I would say crossing the Atlantic nowadays is no more difficult than crossing the road, but you have to know whether the lights are red or green when you start out, and you have to keep your eyes wide open all the way across to look out for icebergs.
Well, now there's some great imagery. Okay, Charles. Hey, where do we go if we want to find out more?
Well, people are very welcome to contact our firm or myself directly by email or by telephone, as they may prefer.
Charles, thanks so much for joining us here on U.S. Law Radio.
Thank you for having me.
That's it, folks. We're out of time. U.S. Law Radio is produced by Roger Yaffe. Send your comments and show ideas his way. This edition of U.S. Law Radio has been brought to you by FCA Limited, forensic engineering and origin cause experts working nationwide since 1970. And by Ringler Associates. Since 1975, Ringler Associates has provided injured parties and their attorneys with the finest structured settlement services. This is Dan Walker. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time for another edition of U.S. Law Radio.